Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.
It's Mental Health Monday. It's Mental Health Monday, episode 150. We are 150 episodes into this incredible journey that we've been on, and thank you to everybody who's been part of the journey so far. It started off way back, surprisingly, with episode number one. And it was all about just having a conversation about mental health. And we've developed it. We did episode two after that. And then shortly after came episode three. And then, well, we thought, what should we call this next one? Episode four seemed like a pretty good idea to go down. And the years have rolled on. But Mental Health Monday continues weekly here on the programme. And we're now up to episode 150. Thank you to everybody who supports the show. Thank you to everybody who's spoken on the show. Thank you to everybody who listens to the show, downloads the Listen Again podcast as well, and who has highlighted some of the work that we've done, who've put us in contact with some wonderful organisations. We are not going anywhere as well. Mental Health Monday will have an episode 151. One and two and three, and we'll set our next date in the diary for around about a year's time, which will be around about Mental Health Monday episode 200. Thank you as ever for your emails. If you want to get involved in the show, you can. If you want to recommend an organisation, we've not got through them all yet. Don't you worry about that. mick@radiocity.co.uk. This one comes through to the show. My name is Freddie. I live in Liverpool. I'm a big fan of your Radio City show. I think it's so important to provide regular, real insight and inspiration to help people battling mental health issues. I think having a regular mental health slot is groundbreaking. So many people need and appreciate the constant support and reminders to take care of their well-being, not just a quick blast every few months. Thank you for your kind words, Freddie, and thank you for sending us an email, mick@radiocity.co.uk, if you'd like to get involved on the programme. Oh, it turns out Freddie's here in the studio. Freddie M. Bennett is our guest on this week's edition of Mental Health Monday. Freddie, great to see you. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon. I am very good and very excited to be here. Congratulations on episode 150.
There we go. Well, we've not done it yet. We never know. I might just lose all the ability to speak or, completely mess it up. Freddie, it's great to get you on the programme.
Thank you.
A really interesting conversation is to come for our listeners today. And you've embarked on some incredible challenges. We'll talk about the challenges you've embarked on and the reasons that you do it. You said in your email, I'm not an athlete, privileged adventurer, or an ex-SAS soldier. We've had some of those people on this programme.
Yep.
You're an everyday guy. Just tell us about yourself. Tell us about how everyday you are, and we'll decide for ourselves, because I think people might think you're a pretty extraordinary chap.
No worries. Thank you again for having me on the show. So my name is Freddie. I'm 38 and I live in Liverpool. I'm married. I've got two children. And for so long, I had what I called quite a frustrated everyday life. I went to school, went to university. I started doing the whole corporate job thing because that's what I felt I had to do. I rose up the corporate ladder, became moderately successful, you could say. The paycheck started getting bigger. The houses got bigger. The cars got nicer. But I felt secretly more and more trapped and more alone and more abandoned. And I started to find, as life outwardly seemed to be very successful, as the lunches got longer and the nights got later and the waistlines got tighter and the parties got heavier, I became more and more alone and abandoned. And it was actually my dad that taught me the purpose of life and how precious life is and that life is short. But unfortunately, he had to teach me that lesson by dying very suddenly. And that gave me that crash course in thinking, really, how do I want to live my life? How can I take myself out of this stressed, depression-focused existence and really start to live the life that I could be proud of and that my kids can be proud of? So through a lot of hard work and a lot of focus and a lot of action, I managed to take these small steps. And I became a Guinness World Record holder. I ran 200 miles through the Sahara Desert. I completed an Ironman, never before having attempted a triathlon, which was a bad idea. I've jumped out of planes. I've dived with great white sharks. I've walked on fire. But you're absolutely right, Mick. My whole thing is that I don't think I'm anyone special. I don't think I'm this elite guy, and I'm certainly not an athlete. I am just an everyday guy who decided to do these extraordinary things. And my whole ethos is that anyone can do this. And if I can do it, if I can take myself off the sofa, if I can turn from being a really overweight, unhealthy, asthmatic child, and if I can take myself to run 200 miles through the burning Sahara Desert, that anyone can do it. And that's what I'm here to do, to help people.
I mean, wow. I mean, that's a pretty good opener, isn't it? And I think people now listening can understand why we've invited you onto the programme. I'll touch on your dad. You touched on the situations you found yourself in. Before I do that, can I ask you about that idea of working the corporate life, playing your role? This is the system we built in this country.
Yep.
You earn your qualifications, you get a job, you climb the ladder, you buy the house, you do what you're told, you pay your bills, you do what you're told, you work for who you're told to work for, and you do what you're told. You live the dream. There'd be a lot of people who were thinking, there you go, Freddie, he's doing it. I always knew he'd make something of himself because of X, Y, or Z. And yet fundamentally, there was something about that existence. Was there a part of you that was thinking, I should be happy now because my house now has four bedrooms. I should be happy now because my car has got heated seats. Was there an element of you that was thinking, what? Why am I not happy about these things if these are the things I'm supposed to want and supposed to desire in life?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a strange way of saying it. It's worth me saying it. I wasn't driving around in Lamborghinis with these plush offices. But yeah, we'll maybe touch on it. But I
just for a record up, there. Heated seats was the poshest thing I could think of for a car.
I know, I was quite jealous.
I was either going to go to heated seats or two cup holders. But that was the poshest one I could go for.
Well, yeah, I'm just aiming for electric windows. So if we can get to that, I'll be happy. So yeah, I know we'll talk about my dad, but growing up, we didn't have much money at all. So for me, it felt like the best thing to do was to do as you said, was to work hard, get my head down, get some qualifications, get an actual job and an actual office. But I remember, even on day one, I was feeling like a fish out of water. And I was telling myself, what's wrong with me? Because you should be loving this. An example be on the first day, I would have been about 24, 25 years old. And it's very, it's very businessy and everyone's there with the boss and they're all talking about networking and Chucky and thought grenades and blue sky thinking and all these things. I was just in the office saying, this coffee machine gives you as many free coffees as you want. That's amazing. And I was so caught up in this world. And I was walking around like a wide-eyed child saying, you got free coffees, free a stapler. I can take a stapler home if I want. And I was in awe, but then I was also intimidated. And very early on, I felt like an imposter. And I think that's something that a lot of people feel when they get put in a position. And in many cases, they've worked hard and they deserve to be there. But they feel like, I'm not good enough. I'm an imposter here. This shouldn't be the life that I'm living. And I felt like that. And as time went on, I did what you're supposed to do. I worked hard. My job involved a lot of travel. So I was away from my family when my wife was pregnant with our first child. I was out in the Middle East and I was missing all these key moments in my life. But I thought, well, this is the way it has to be. I've got a choice. I can be successful at work or I can be happy at home. And for me, probably wrongly, I thought, well, I need to be successful at work. And it's probably quite a macho male thing as well, where you think, I have to go and be the breadwinner. I have to go and earn the money and get the success. And I was totally wrong in that.
Well, I guess that planning's fine, isn't it? If you think, you know what, for a few years, I just need to knuckle down and get on with things, get a bit of cash, in the bank, crack on with a mortgage. And then maybe as the kids get into primary school, then maybe we're in a position to be able to sort of kick back. But people don't do that, do they? People don't go, I've been offered a little bit more and my pay increase has gone up a little bit more. I got the option of buying a slightly bigger house with a slightly bigger garden. That's not the point that people then go, you know what? I've worked hard for a few years and now I'm just going to get, I'm going to downsize. We just don't do that, do we? We're not sort of bred to do that. So that idea that you put a line in the sand and suddenly go, right, things are going to be different tomorrow, becomes a huge change, presumably.
Yeah, and you know what? I did that twice. I had twice in my career when you sit down with your partner and you have the chat and you say, look, I'm really not happy here. And I know that my mental health is taking a hit and I don't want to live my life making other people richer. I don't want to be living someone else's dream. And you have the chat and sometimes you build up the confidence and you say, right, we're going to do this. This is it. This is the first moment of the next day of my life of a new chapter. And then you think, but the kids need some new shoes or the Christmas present they've been asking for, or we'd like to be able to afford a holiday this year. And you say to yourself, right, I'll just do the next project, the next promotion, the next big meeting. And you always look forward and forward. And it's so much of what I do is about helping people to step out of their comfort zones. But in this case, I was, and I'll fully admit, I was trapped in that comfortable lifestyle that wouldn't let myself escape.
Was it your dad's death that was the moment where you suddenly thought, oh, this might be the moment?
It was, and yeah, that was a big turning point. I think from a mental health point of view, it was actually before then. So I had a moment at work, and it was really strange. I'd been working so hard for a big promotion, and I know it, you know, it sounds so materialistic on the surface, and I'd been working hard for it, and I'd got that promotion, and I'd been out celebrating. And I remember that night, it was a summer's evening, but it just felt like I was overcome by this darkness. And I was sat in my hotel room, surrounded by empty bottles. And I thought, I can't go on like this. I know I have to find a way out of this situation. And then it hit me like a thunderbolt. And I thought, I've got a solution. But unfortunately, that solution was to think about killing myself, which was obviously a very permanent solution to a temporary problem. But thanks to the help of therapy and the help of the Samaritans, sometimes being on speed dial, I got through that and I picked myself up and I carried on with my life. And then it was my dad's death again. As I say, it gave me a crash course in life being short.
With that, in terms of the conversation, you mentioned speaking to Samaritans. Did you have conversations with people who had seen you work hard for the promotion, achieve the promotion, seen you maybe celebrating and thinking, oh, Freddie's got it made. Freddie's achieving his goals there. Was that something you had to deal with, that idea, the perception of Freddie, the guy who works hard and sort of does well at work, versus the reality of what Freddie was feeling at that particular time?
Yep, absolutely. So I wore two masks every day. There was Freddie, the hard worker, the guy who was outwardly successful, and there was also Freddie, the socializer. Now, there was used to be a name for me called Funtime Freddy. And it's fair to say I liked to party, and I was always at the centre of every social occasion. If I wasn't at the centre of the occasion, I'd be at the bar. You know, I'd be the first person at a social event. I'd be the last person to leave, the first to get shots in, the first to say, let's go to a nightclub. But the truth was that I was just, again, I was adopting that persona because firstly, I felt that's what people expected of me. And secondly, to really mask that unhappiness. And it's a vicious cycle because the more unhappy you feel, the more you think things like, well, you know, I'll have a night out or I'll have a drink. And that makes you feel better for a few hours. But then the next day you feel more pressure, you're more stressed and more tired at work. Your mental health takes another kick. And then it all starts to build up and build up into this mountain of pressure. And you don't know how to deal with it because people think of you in a certain way. And you don't have the courage or the confidence to put your hand up and say, actually, this is me and the real me needs some help.
No, absolutely. I think there'll be loads of people who listen to this who will head out and will work Monday to Friday, Monday to Saturday, and they will think, I'm only a round of shots away from happiness. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like it's that thing of, you know, the later you get on into the night and everyone's having a good time, or they're not having a good time, then somebody brings over a round of shots and you're thinking, is this going to be the thing that's going to turn this from an okay night into a great night? Or is this the thing that's going to, you know, they have that thing about borrowing happiness from tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, when you go, well, if I have a bit more happiness here and I don't have it tomorrow, well, I can take that because tomorrow I don't need to do anything. I think that's part of the thing of our relationship with alcohol as well, where it's there to celebrate, but it's also there to commiserate. It's there for the good times, there for the bad times as well. But it's a constant factor in people's lives. Freddie is with us on the program. How comfortable are you talking about your daddy? Okay,
if I ask you
just in terms of that, because I know any form of sudden death is not great, and of course it can really shake the foundations. And of course, losing your dad in the way that you did, say, suggesting is sort of the next step, if you like, in terms of your new outlook on life.
Yeah, absolutely. So I remember it clearly. It was a couple of years ago now, and I was at work, and I was being that guy at work that I didn't want to be. I was there in my suit, eating a sandwich at my desk, looking at a computer with a crashed spreadsheet, and you're just there saying, oh man, how can my life get any worse? Surely there's nothing worse that could happen today. And then the phone rang, and you know, 300 miles and 5 hours frantically driven later, I was by his bedside in an intensive care unit, still in my work suit with nothing on me apart from a laptop bag, and he was there unconscious, and he'd been perfectly well that morning. And I went into this room, and it's like you see on TV. It's a dark room in intensive care. And then the doctors call you into the private room and they have the chat and they say there's nothing you can do. And we need to say goodbye. And it's funny when you're there in real life, because there's the one doctor trying to have this very sensitive conversation, and the other doctors look at his watch thinking, well, we're stressed NHS doctors, we need to get around with our shift. To cut a very quick and tragic story short, I was having a normal day until lunchtime. Then 6 o'clock that evening, I kissed my father on the forehead and watched him die. And then you step out into this new world afterwards. And it's strange. You see everyone else going around their lives and people are just carrying on. But you're there thinking, well, my world's just fallen apart. And I was still there thinking on that day of, he didn't know he was going to die that morning. And what regrets would he have had? How would he have looked back on his life? Would he have been proud of the things he did or the things he didn't do? And what would he have done differently if he'd had his time again? And that gave me that push that I needed to really try and turn my life around and to take a good hard look in the mirror and think, are you really living the life you want to lead, the one that you want to make your children proud of? And, you know, heaven forbid it won't be for a good few years for me, but I know, unfortunately, it is going to come to all of us. Death is one thing we can't avoid. And I want to make sure that when I'm in that position, I want to look back with a smile and think of all the wonderful things I've done and the people I've helped. And hopefully I can help other people do the same.
But you wanted to do things. You wanted to do something else. You wanted to reflect on life, but also have aspiration and ambition to do new things. What was there a small step that you took, or did you jump in 2 feet into some incredible challenge?
So I jumped in pretty big and pretty 2 feet. So, you know, we've talked about my dad's death. And if you can imagine, it was a couple of months after. I was still feeling lost. I was overweight. At that stage, I was still drinking too much. There's this guy on the sofa. The only kind of marathon that I would go through would be a Netflix marathon. And I was thinking, I need to do something big here. I need to be able to show my children and, more importantly, myself what I'm capable of. So I thought, you know, what do I do? Do I start doing park runs? Do I do a marathon? Do I look at triathlon? But I said no to all of those things. I signed up for the world's toughest foot race.
Now, if you'd have just said I did couch to 5K, we'd have gone, fair enough, you know. He's on the sofa there. You know, he's had some tough times, but he's getting back on his feet. But you thought, no, I'm going big.
That's exactly what I thought.
Is there something about you, do you think, that needs that drive, that needs an end goal?
I think there is, to be honest. I think people have said that, you know, we've talked about mental illness, but people have questioned it in terms of my activity choices. But my whole concept is, and in everything I do, I know the stuff I do is extreme, but for me, it's not about, say, being an athlete or fitness or anything at all. It's about setting yourself outside of your comfort zone. And for me, really, it's about time. And I thought, I don't know how much time I've got left. None of us do. So I had all these sensible options in front of me. And I was on Google one day and this race came up and it said, the world's toughest foot race.
Go on, give us the spec. What makes it the world's toughest foot race?
So it was 200 miles through the Sahara Desert, where temperatures reach 55 degrees Celsius. It is a self-supported race. So effectively, it is 7 marathons in 6 days. Self-supported, which means you carry all your food or your clothes or your equipment on your back. And you go from place to place through the Sahara Desert. So it's not like you
not
do
running
a run.
On sand, are you?
Yep. Running on sand. We were running across sand dunes that were 10 kilometres wide. It was running up sand dunes that were a kilometre high. It was arid riverbeds that were baked hard by the sun. It's pretty much the most inhospitable, most horrible environment you can imagine.
Was the part of you that was going, this was what I needed, this is what I was looking for? Or were you just thinking, I just need to stay alive for this experience?
Yeah, some people said to me there are easier ways of having a midlife crisis. I could have just bought a motorbike. But I thought I need to do this. I need to prove to myself. And quite frankly, because I needed something quite big and quite scary to be able to get myself off the sofa. And I said, I'd done a bit of exercise before. I completed the London Marathon in 2012 and it had been an absolute disaster. You know, the London Marathon, it's it's very London. It's very people saying, you know, oh darling, you must do the London Marathon. It, you know, the crowd is wonderful. The atmosphere is fantastic. I thought it was the worst day of my life.
Right.
It took me 6 hours. I sat down and cried a couple of times. I got a knee injury and I just thought, you know what? I'm not a runner. But then this challenge came up and I thought, if I'm going to really demonstrate to myself and to my loved ones that I'm serious about turning my life around, I need to do something big to prove that to myself.
And you did that, but then you did do the London Marathon. Oh, you did a marathon again. Was it the London Marathon you did dressed as a fisherman?
No, that was the Liverpool Marathon.
You did the Liverpool Marathon.
Liverpool Marathon last year.
So you thought, you know what? I will do a marathon again, and this time I'll do it wearing a pair of wellies.
Yep, and the reason behind that was, say, I went through the Sahara Desert, and that was, say, the toughest thing I'd ever done for, you know, it was a week long. We got hit by tornadoes, there were sandstorms. It was, you know, the toughest week ever. And I came home with my medal and all my stories, speaking to my children around the dinner table, and they were saying, nah, Daddy, I'm not impressed anymore. And my children are 5 and 7, and they got the Guinness World Records for their Christmas present. And they were flicking through it one day, and they said, well, Daddy, you did that thing with the sand, but we want you to break a Guinness World Record now. So I took a deep breath and got the Guinness World Records out, and I thought, right, well, I've done a bit of running, it's fair to say, with the whole thing in the Sahara Desert. So why not go back to marathon land and try and do something a little bit different?
So there was no, or was there an official record for?
Yep, so there was an official record. So the official record was the fastest marathon ever dressed as a fisherman.
And that was currently, it was held at?
That was held by someone in America, and it was 4 hours, 45 minutes.
And did you think, I can do that?
Yeah, I did. Well, before I read the instructions, so I did do it. and like maybe you'll learn with me, I didn't think all these things through properly. I thought, I'm going to smash out of my comfort zone. And you know, you see online with all the celebrities and everything, and it's all quite macho with, you know, the SAS Who Dares Wins guys and David Goggins and Bear Grylls. And it's all very smash your comfort zone, be your best version of yourself. And you know what? I think also for men especially, when you're suffering with mental health issues, the last thing you want is a load of really butch guys telling you to go on, smash it, when you think all I want to do is sit on the sofa and feel sorry for myself. But I thought, how can I do this challenge? And probably a bit arrogantly, I thought, 4 hours, 45 minutes, that, you know, I've run through the desert, that's easy. But then I read the instructions properly, and I read the bit about welly boots.
So presumably when you're doing a world record, it's not just throw a pair of wellies on and a daft hat and start running. There are specific elements of
the,
that.
The Guinness World Records, they are a tough bunch of people. I had about 5 pages of different rules and regulations. I had to get my costume checked and analysed before I did the attempt. But the official outfit was, I had to wear bright yellow waterproofs. So let's ignore the wellies for a second. Doing a marathon in hopefully a hot British summer in May, in full head-to-toe bright polyester waterproofs with a hat and carrying a 3 kilo fishing box.
Oh, wow. Have you ever been fishing?
No, I have not.
So you didn't even have the kit. You had to go out and get it.
Yep, had to buy all the kit. And it was my youngest son, Luke. You know, he's 5 and he loves the sea and he loves fishes. And I thought it'd be quite nice as well to represent the proud maritime tradition of Liverpool. And I thought, well, the outfit's a bit hot, but you know what? I've been in the desert. I can deal with heat. But then the welly boots was a problem. And you couldn't adapt them. You couldn't slip a pair of Nike Airs in them. You had to wear a proper standard pair of welly boots that got checked.
So you're looking at 4:45, you say?
Yeah.
And you came in at?
I came in at 4:37.
Oh, excellent. There we go.
Well,
and
you
see, you get into the Guinness Book of World Records.
So I'm in there. I'm on the website now. I'm hopefully going to be...
Have you impressed the kids?
I am. They are impressed. They were actually impressed for almost a whole week. But that was, in a way, that was tougher than the desert in terms of the metaphors it has and going through mental health in your own life as well, because firstly, I wasn't prepared for it, which was, again, a bad idea. I'd been on one training run for 1 mile in the outfit. The problem being, I rent around Sefton Park, near where I live in Liverpool. There was a lovely old lady walking her dog. And imagine, if you will, you're a nice, pleasant little old lady with walking pebbles the dog, and then a man bursts out of the undergrowth, head to toe in yellow, carrying a bright red box, I look like a cross between the world's worst male stripper and a serial killer. The poor lady almost had a heart attack, so I had to stop and apologise to her. And I thought, right, the welly boots need to go back in the cupboard now until race day.
There's obviously the physical challenge that comes with this, but it's important to talk about the mental side of things as well. How have you found that development now in terms of trying to find a life balance between obviously paying the bills and making things work, but also taking part in these challenges and having that family time as well, you know, the thing that we all sort of yearn for as well. Is that a balance you still work on and that you still look to strike?
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think if you ask my wife, she'd probably say I haven't got it quite right yet, but it's, we do have a lot of pressures on us every day. And like I said, I know the stuff I do is extreme, but for anyone in life, they have things they want to achieve and they want to accomplish. They also have to pay the bills and have a happy home life. And I think it's, if you focus too much on one of those things, then it makes everything else worthless, because you have to have that balance. And I think from my point of view, it's about getting that balance right between making sure that people are happy at home, and especially you know, my wife and children. If they're not happy, then I'm not happy. But I also know, I think from a mental health point of view, selfish isn't the right word, but sometimes we have to prioritise ourselves and our health. And that's when everyone is demanding things from us, and not necessarily at home, but when you've got friends or wider family members saying, oh, you need to do this or you need to do that, and almost making you feel guilty. Even now, I recognise I have to put my hand up and say, look, I need to take some time out for myself and for my mental health, just to make sure I'm on an even keel. Sometimes you have to be a little bit selfish in the short term to make sure that you could be the best version of yourself in the weeks, months, years to come.
Absolutely. And of course, it's that thing, isn't it? If there's a problem on an aeroplane, make sure you put your own life mask on first before you help other people. And I think that analogy has been touched on before on the programme. I've got to ask you what you're going to do next. What's your next incredible challenge? I think you're going north, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going north. So, well, the main challenge at the moment is early 2021. It's a 200-mile ultramarathon through the frozen Arctic. So I'm swapping sand for snow. It's very much the same. I say it's 200 miles, 6 days, carrying everything on your back. But in this case, because it's cold, they tell us that if we stop for too long, then we start to die from hypothermia.
Ah.
So that's always nice, isn't it?
Yeah. When does that start?
That's February next year.
Right, okay. Well, at least we've had some decent weather in the last few weeks. You know, yeah. You might have prepared yourself for it in some way. Freddie, best luck with the training for that.
Thank you. I think I'll need it.
And finding the right preparation time for that as well, and generally staying alive through that process, because that sounds like it's going to be a pretty extreme thing. Social media is a good place to keep on top of sort of where you're at in terms of the work you're doing, the inspiring work as well, if people want to make contact with you as well. Instagram the best place for
it? Yep, Instagram, that's the one. So it's Freddie Explores on Instagram. FREDDIE explores. It's worth saying as well that in all the challenges that I've done in terms of the Sahara Desert and what I'll be doing for the Arctic Ultramarathon as well, it's raising money for charity. So my charity is CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably. They've helped me in the past, and they help so many other people out there to really improve their mental health and live a life that they're capable of.
Brilliant stuff. We wish you the best with all the future endeavours as well, both your physical and mental health as well, to you and your family. Thank you for sharing your story with us, Freddie. Thanks for joining us for episode 150 of Mental Health Monday.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a suitably epic one, I think. thank you for your time. Don't forget, if you want to find mental health services close to you, you can do so using the Hub of Hope. Type that into the website, hubofhope.co.uk, or use the app. It'll use the location on your device to find mental health services close to you. Calm Zone is a good place to go as well. The calmzone.net, I think, is the website. A really good website with loads of incredible information on there too.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle
on Radio City Talk.